National Public Radio, in association with Independent Radio Drama Productions, presents one of the cases of Sherlock Holmes, with Edward Petherbridge as Sherlock Holmes and David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. These two principals will be noticeably absent from this edition of our saga. This is episode 5 of the very first published Sherlock Holmes adventure, A Study in Scarlet. The original story was divided into 3 parts. The first introduced Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John H. Watson. It then followed Holmes as he investigated the baffling murder of an American named Enoch J. Drebber at Lauriston Gardens. Before the investigation ended, a second American, Joseph Stangerson, had also been killed. At the conclusion of the first part, Holmes solved the crime and produced the killer, an American named Jefferson Hope. Hope suffers from a fatal heart condition, and feeling death is near, he tells his tale. The story of Jefferson Hope makes up part 2 of A Study in Scarlet, which Arthur Conan Doyle subtitled The Country of the Saints. The third part, the shortest of the 3, concludes the story and ties up all the loose ends. Set in Utah, part 2 begins with the miraculous rescue of the 2 survivors of a doomed wagon train. John Ferrier and little Lucy Ferrier are found by a pioneering band of Mormons who are themselves searching for the promised land. As a condition of rescue, Ferrier agrees to embrace the Mormon religion, and he follows the caravan to Salt Lake City. Time passes, and Lucy grows into a lovely woman, the flower of Utah, as Conan Doyle calls her. She has just met a handsome cowboy named Jefferson Hope as we begin episode 5 of A Study in Scarlet. Remember now, Jefferson Hope is telling his tale to Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and a pair of Scotland Yard inspectors.
You can't believe how the sight of this fair young girl, as frank and wholesome as the Sierra breezes, had stirred my untamed heart to its very depths. We had been prospecting for silver in the Nevada mountains, yet the love which sprang in my heart was so wild and fierce that I could think of nothing else. I wooed that young woman harder than I had explored any silver lode. Night after night, I called on John Ferrier and talked my heart away in the company of Lucy's bright, happy eyes, which told me her young heart was no longer her own. I am off, Lucy. I won't ask you to come with me now. But will you be ready to come when I appear again?
And when will that be?
A couple of months at the outside. I will come and claim you then. There's no one who can stand between us.
And Father?
He's given his consent. Provided we can get these mines working all right, I have no fear on that head.
In that case, there's no more to be said.
Why, thank God. Settled. But the longer I stay here, the harder it'll be to go. They're waiting for me at the canyon. Goodbye, my darling. Goodbye. In 2 months' time, I shall see you.
Our women in the land of the saints are few, and our men need wives.
I will not allow Lucy to marry a Mormon. Victims of persecutors are now turned persecutors.
Swift retribution will fall on the heads of those who cast perverted clouds over the state of Utah.
Brother Cookson held out against the church and vanished away.
God has exacted punishment on the deviant.
His wife and children waited home, but he did not return.
The judges have spoken. Amen.
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 One rash word. One hasty act. Annihilation.
Praise the Lord God of Zion. The prophet delivered unto us the brides of our future.
Pining, weeping women that bear upon their faces the traces of inextinguishable horror.
The Indians are murdering immigrants hereabouts and stealing the white women.
Suddenly appearing in the harems of elders.
Armed, masked men, stealthy, noiseless, flitting through the darkness.
The avenging angels.
Brother Ferrier, The true believers have been good friends to you. We picked you up when you were starving in the desert. We shared our food with you, led you safe to the chosen valley, gave you a goodly share of land, and allowed you to wax rich under our protection. Is this not so?
It is so.
In return for all this, we asked but one condition. That was that you should embrace the true faith and conform in every way to its usages. This you promised to do. And this, if common report says truly, you have neglected.
And how have I neglected it? Have I not given to the common fund? Have I not attended at the temple? Have I not?
Where are your wives? Call them in, that I may greet them.
It is true that I have not married. But women are few, and there were many who had better claims than I. I was not a lonely man. I had my daughter to attend to my wants.
It is of that daughter that I would speak to you. She has grown to be the flower of Utah, and has found favor in the eyes of many who are high in the land.
Oh.
There are stories of her which I would fain disbelieve. Stories that she is sealed to some Gentile. This must be the gossip of idle tongues. What is the 13th rule in the code of the sainted Joseph Smith? Let every maiden of the true faith marry one of the elect. For if she wed a Gentile, she commits a grievous sin. This being so, it is impossible that you, who profess the holy creed, should suffer your daughter to violate it. Upon this one point, your whole faith shall be tested. So it has been decided in the Sacred Council of Four. The girl is young, and we would not have her wed gray hairs. Neither would we deprive her of all choice. We elders have many heifers, but our children must also be provided. Stangerson has a son, and Drebber has a son, and either of them would gladly welcome your daughter to their house. Let her choose between them. They are young and rich and of the true faith. What say you to that?
You will give us time. My daughter is very young, and she is scarce of an age to marry.
She shall have a month to choose. At the end of that time, she shall give her answer. It were better for you, John Ferrier, that you and she were now lying blanched skeletons upon the Sierra Blanco, than that you should put your weak wills against the orders of the Holy Four.
Father?
Lucy.
I could not help it. His voice rang through the house. Oh, Father. Father, what should we do?
Don't scare yourself. We'll fix it up somehow or other. You don't find your fancy kind of lessening for this fellow Jefferson, do you?
No, Father.
No. Of course not. I shouldn't care to hear you say you did. He's a likely lad, and he's a Christian, which is more than these folk here, in spite of all their praying and preaching. There's a party starting from Nevada tomorrow, and I'll manage to send him a message letting him know the hole we're in. If I know anything of that young man, he'll be back here with a speed that would whip electrotelegraphs. When he comes, he'll advise us for the best. But it is for you that I am close of it. Something terrible always happens to them.
But we haven't opposed him yet.
It'll be time to look out for squalls when we do. We have a clear month before us. At the end of that, I guess we had best shin out of Utah.
Leave Utah?
That's about the size of it.
But the farm...
We will raise as much as we can in money and let the rest go. To tell the truth, Lucy, it isn't the first time I have thought of doing it. I don't care for knuckling under to any man, as these folk do to their darned prophet. I'm a freeborn American, and it's all new to me. Guess I'm too old to learn.
If he comes browsing about this farm, he might chance to run up against a charge of buckshot traveling in the opposite direction.
But they won't let us leave.
Wait till Jefferson comes, and we'll soon manage that. In the meantime, don't fret yourself. And don't get your eyes swelled up, else he'll be tearing into me when he sees you. There's nothing to be afraid about. And there's no danger at all.
On that very morning, John Ferrier went into Salt Lake City, tracked down his acquaintance bound for the Nevada mountains, and entrusted him with the secret message to me. As he approached his farm, he was surprised to see a horse hitched to each of the posts of the gate. Still more surprised was he on entering to find two young men occupying his sitting room. One, with a long, pale face, was leaning back in the rocking chair with his feet cocked up upon the stove. The other, a bull-necked youth with coarse, bloated features, was standing in front of the window with his hands in his pockets, whistling.
Maybe you don't know us. This here is the son of Elder Drebber, and I'm Joseph Stangerson, son of Elder Stangerson, who traveled with you in the desert when the Lord stretched out his hand and gathered you into the true fold.
As he will all the nations in his own good time, he grindeth slowly but exceedingly small.
And we have come, at the advice of our fathers, to solicit the hand of your daughter for whichever of us may seem good to you and to her. As I have but four wives and Brother Drebber here has seven, it appears to me that my claim is the stronger one.
Nay, Brother Stangerson, the question is not how many wives we have, but how many wives we can keep.
I shall have his tanning yard and his leather factory. Then I am your elder and am higher in the church.
It will be for the maiden to decide. We will leave it all to her decision.
Look here. When my daughter summons you, you can come. But until then, I don't want to see your faces here again. There are two ways out of the room. There is the door and there is the window. Now, which do you care to use? Let me know when you have settled which it is to be.
You shall smart for this. You have defied the prophet and the council of four. You shall rue it to the end of your days.
The hand of the Lord shall be upon you. He will rise and smite you.
Then I'll start the smiting.
Father! Oh, no, Father. Let them go.
The young canting rascals. I would sooner see you in your grave, my girl, than the wife of either of them.
And so should I, Father. But Jefferson will soon be here.
Yes. It will not be long before he comes. The sooner the better. For we do not know what their next move will be.
In the whole history of the settlement, there has never been such a case of rank disobedience to the authority of the elders.
What shall be the fate of this arch rebel?
His wealth and position shall be of no avail to him. Others as well known and as rich as him have been snatched by the talons of the Lord and cast to the depths of hell.
He will be born.
The avenging angels shall pin their remonstrance to the very cover of his bed, and they shall say, 29 days are given for amendment, and then
the hand which fastened his head might just as well have struck him through the heart.
And the next morning the avenging angels shall mark his seating with a burn stick, and they shall say the number 28.
And on the following morning the number 27 shall be painted upon the outside of his door.
And this register shall be kept daily upon the walls, sometimes upon the floors, occasionally on small placards nailed to the garden gate and railings.
See how haggard and restless the dream becomes.
He has the eyes of a hunted and wretched creature. 20 to 15, and 15 to 10. Five to four and four to three, he cast his eyes north to south and east to west. We have his farm surrounded.
No road unguarded. 3 to 2.
What the hell is that? So they have come.
Perhaps this is their way of marking up that the last day of grace has arrived. I will present them with a ready target. Instant death is better than this torturing of the nerves. Nobody. Good God. Some wounded or dying man. Hey. You okay? Good Lord. Oh, you scared me. Whatever made you come in like that?
Give me food. I haven't had time to eat for 2 days.
Here, son. You don't know how glad I am to see you.
Does Lucy bear up well?
Yes. And she does not know the real danger.
Well, that is well. The house is watched on every side. That is why I crawled my way up to it. They may be darn sharp, but they're not quite sharp enough to catch a Washoe hunter.
You're a man to be proud of. There are not many who would come to share our danger and our troubles.
Well, you've hit it there, Bart. I have respect for you. But if you were alone in this business, I'd think twice before I put my head into such a hornet's nest. It's Lucy that brings me here. And before harm comes on her, I guess there will be one less of the Hope family in Utah.
What are we to do?
Tomorrow is your last day. Unless you act tonight, you are lost. I have a mule and 2 horses waiting in the Eagle Ravine. How much money have you got?
$2,000 in gold and $5,000 in notes.
That'll do. I have as much more to add to it. We must push for Carson City through the mountains. You'd best wake Lucy. It's as well that the servants do not sleep in the house.
John Ferrier woke Lucy to prepare her for our journey. I packed all the provisions into a small parcel and filled the stoneware jar with water. The mountain wells were few and far between. Ferrier appeared with Lucy, all dressed and ready, and looking more beautiful than I had ever remembered her. We had a few precious minutes to smile and embrace.
We must make our start at once. The front and back entrances are watched, but if we're careful, we might get away through the side windows and across the fields. Once on the road, we're only 2 miles from the ravine where the horses are waiting. By daybreak, we should be halfway through the mountains.
What if we are stopped?
Well, if they are too many for us, we shall take 2 or 3 of them with us.
When a dark cloud obscured the moonlight, we stumbled across the garden with bated breath and crouching as low as our bodies could hold us above the ground. We followed the line of a sheltering hedge until we came to a gap, which opened up into the cornfield. Suddenly. Town!
Tomorrow, at midnight, when the whippoorwill calls 3 times.
It is well. Shall I tell Brother Drebber?
Pass it on to him. And from him to the others. 9 to 7.
7 to 5.
Now, quickly. Hurry on. Hurry on.
I can't keep up.
Here, give me your arm. Hurry. We are through the line of sentinels. Everything depends on speed. Hurry on. We made it to the canyon. Lucy went upon the mule, Hold Ferrier upon one of the horses, and I led the other horse along the precipitous and dangerous path. Up the great black crag 1,000 feet high, with long basaltic columns on the rugged surface like the ribs of some petrified monster. On the other side, there was a wild chaos of boulders and debris. Soon we reached the wildest and most desolate portion of the pass.
Look.
Who goes there?
Travelers from Nevada.
By whose permission?
The Holy Four.
9 to 7?
7 to 5.
Pass and the Lord go with you.
Looking back, we could see the solitary watcher leaning upon his gun, and we knew that we had passed the outlying post of the chosen people, and that freedom lay before us. We rode and climbed the mountains, passing wild torrents. Lucy and old Ferrier wanted to rest longer during the watering of the horses, but I knew the avenging angels were on our trail. Everything depended on speed. After 2 days, there was no way of telling how far behind us they were.
Are you all right, Father?
I am fine, child. I have the strength to hold on to the mane of this old horse. That's strength enough to take us to Carson.
What are you doing? Now the sun is still up, we can move on.
Our food has run out. We can't go on without more provisions. I reckon if you make a fire here, there's game to be had in these mountains. And I won't be long.
And the Mormons?
Well, we must be 30 miles ahead of them. Enough time to gather food and fight them.
Don't be long.
I'll be as quick as I can. Warm yourselves on this fire. It must be 5,000 feet up. It's no wonder the air is bitter and keen. I left them crouching over the blazing fire, while the three animals stood motionless in the background. Then, the intervening rocks hid them from my view. I walked 2 miles or more through one ravine after another before spying a creature like a giant sheep, the bighorn. I shot him, and he fell down into the valley below. He was far too big to carry on my back, so I cut away one haunch and part of the flank and tried to retrace my steps. Evening was drawing in. I reckon I must have lost my bearings. I had to try all manner of turns and routes, and it must have been 5 hours before I recognized the outline of the cliffs that bound the glen I had left them in.
Hello! Hello!
I found the spot where the fire had been lit. Just a glowing pile of wood ashes there, and dead silence. No living creature near the fire remains. Animal, man, maiden, all gone. I seized a piece of wood from the smoldering fire and blew it into a flame. I could see the ground all stamped down by the feet of horses, and the direction of their tracks proved that afterwards they had turned back to Salt Lake City. Maybe they had taken old Ferrier and Lucy back with them. But my eyes then fell upon an object which made every nerve within my body chill to the core. A little way on one side of the camp was a low-lying heap of reddish soil. There was no mistaking it for anything but a newly dug grave. There was a stick planted on it with a sheet of paper fluttering in the cleft fork. The inscription was brief, but to the point. John Ferrier, formerly of Salt Lake City, died August 4th, 1860.
Good day to you, sir.
I am Jefferson Hope. You remember me?
Good God. You are mad to come here. It's as much as my own life is worth to be seen talking with you. Have you not heard? There is a warrant against you from the Holy Four for assisting the Ferriers away.
I don't fear them or their warrant. You must know something of this matter, Cooper. I beg you to answer just a few questions. We have always been friends. For God's sake, don't refuse to answer me.
What is it? Be quick. The very rocks have ears and the trees eyes.
What has become of Lucy Ferrier?
She was married yesterday to young Drebber.
Oh.
Hold up, man. Hold up. You have no life left in you.
Don't mind me. Married, you say?
Married yesterday. That's what those flags are for on the endowment house. There were some words between young Drebber and young Stangerson as to which was to have her. They'd both been in the party that followed them, and Stangerson shot her father, which seemed to give him the best claim. But when they argued it out in council, Drebber's party was the stronger, so the prophet gave her over to him. No one won't have her very long, though, for I saw death in her face yesterday. She's more like a ghost than a woman. Are you off, then?
Yes, I'm off.
Where are you going?
Never mind!
The trader's daughter is miserable in the hands of Elder Drebber's son.
She has pined away her life. No matter to Drebber, he will inherit her father's farm.
He has no grief for his young bride.
His other wives sat round the bier into the early hours.
They say the ghost of the Gentile broke in and kissed her cold forehead.
And snatched Trevor's wedding ring from her finger.
And cursed, she shall not be buried in that.
They say he prowls the mountains.
A bullet has whistled through young Stangerson's window and flattened itself against the wall within a foot of his face.
A great boulder has crashed down within a foot of young Trevor at the cliff face.
They are leading expeditions into the mountains to kill the Gentile.
They never go out after nightfall and have their houses guarded.
But now the hills are quiet. They say the fire of vengeance has burnt out his heart.
And the mountain birds nest in his undiscovered skeleton.
Five years it took to recover my strength and wealth in the silver mines of Nevada. I returned to Salt Lake City, disguised and under an assumed name. But the chosen people had fought amongst themselves, and young Trevor and Stangerson had left Utah and become Gentiles. I traveled from town to town throughout the United States. Year passed into year, until I faced Trevor in the window of a store in Cleveland, Ohio. Trevor had recognized the murder in my eyes and persuaded a judge to lock me up with the story that I represented the jealousy and hatred of an old rival. When at last I was liberated on sureties, I found Trevor's house deserted and that he had departed with Stangerson for Europe. Now, Stangerson had fallen on hard times and was now acting as Trevor's secretary. I was determined to track down my enemies from city to city, from St. Petersburg to Paris, from Copenhagen to London.
Sherlock Holmes explains it all in the next and final episode of A Study in Scarlet. Edward Petherbridge is Sherlock Holmes, with David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. In the Utah sequence featured in this episode, Richard Gofton was John Ferrier, Lorelei King was Lucy Ferrier, and Vincent Marzella was Jefferson Hope. Other cast members heard were William Roberts, Beau Light, Aaron Schwartz, Stuart Milligan, and Mark Cavern. I'm Steve Zakar. Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and Bramley Pacific, master developer of Oakland, California's City Center Office Development. This is NPR, National Public Radio. National Public Radio, in association with Independent Radio Drama Productions, presents one of the cases of Sherlock Holmes, with Edward Petherbridge as Sherlock Holmes and David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. This is the final episode of A Study in Scarlet. The story is told by Dr. John H. Watson, who was wounded in the Second Afghan War and released from the Army. Once in London, Watson seeks a companion to share his lodging costs and is introduced to Mr. Sherlock Holmes. Watson quickly discovers that Sherlock Holmes is not your average roommate. He keeps odd hours, is always experimenting with chemicals, has a curious assortment of visitors, and is forever reading about the most lurid crimes of the past. Watson finally corners his companion and asks him what exactly it is that he does for a living. Holmes answers that he is the world's first consulting detective. Using his specialized knowledge of science and criminals, along with amazing abilities for observation and deduction, Holmes helps the police and others solve the most baffling puzzles. Holmes is asked by Scotland Yarders Gregson and Lestrade to help them solve the murder of a visiting American named Enoch J. Trevor. Holmes asks Watson to accompany him as he looks into the matter. Drebber's body was found, without a mark of violence on it, at number 3 Lauriston Gardens. Among the clues uncovered at the scene are a woman's wedding ring and the word Rache, R-A-C-H-E, written in blood near the body. Holmes startles the policeman with a fairly detailed description of the murderer, which they choose to ignore. He leaves them to pursue his own lines of inquiry while they hunt after sense of their own. Holmes first tries to bait a trap using the wedding ring. He advertises that it has been found near Lauriston Gardens and invites its owner to recover it. To his surprise, an old woman shows up and claims it. When Holmes tries to follow her, she proves his equal and eludes him. Holmes now turns to a gang of street urchins, which he jokingly calls his Baker Street irregulars. He sends them out to check the various cabs in the city to find the one that he knows from its wheel prints was at the murder scene that night. Meanwhile, Gregson and Lestrade have been following their own clues, and each shows up at Holmes' lodgings to tell their story. Gregson's proves an utter dead end. Lestrade went after the dead man's traveling companion, another American, Joseph Stangerson. He reports that he found Stangerson murdered, stabbed, and near the body was the word Roque, written in blood. Among the items found on the scene was a pill case with two pills in it. Holmes now knows how the first man was killed and shows the Scotland Yarders that one of the pills contains a powerful poison. At that moment, one of the irregulars pops in and announces that the cab driver Mr. Holmes has been seeking is downstairs. Holmes asks the cabbie to come up and presents him to the startled detectives as Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Drebber and Joseph Stangerson. Once in custody, Hope reveals that he is dying from a heart ailment and wants to clear his conscience before he dies. He tells the story of the New World, about a man and young girl who are rescued from certain death in the Utah desert and brought into the fold of the Mormon community. The girl grows into a beautiful woman who falls in love with a cowboy and prospector, Jefferson Hope. She is also the object of attention for two sons of Mormon elders determined to have their way. Enoch Drebber and Joseph Stangerson threaten the girl's father with the terror of the avenging angels. The girl, her father, and Jefferson Hope try to flee but are caught. Hope escapes. The girl is taken back and her father killed. She is forced to marry one of the two men who murdered her father. Her spirit is broken and she is dead within a month. Jefferson Hope vows revenge and has tracked the two all over the world. The chase finally ended in London. Jefferson Hope has just finished his tale as we join the sixth and concluding episode of the Sherlock Holmes adventure, A Study in Scarlet.
It doesn't much matter to you why I hated these men. It's enough that they were guilty of the death of two human beings, a father and a daughter, and that they had therefore forfeited their own lives. After the lapse of time that has passed since their crime, it was impossible for me to secure a conviction against them in any court. I knew of their guilt, though, and I determined that I should be judge, jury, and executioner all rolled into one. You'd have done the same if you had any manhood in you, if you'd been in my place. That girl that I spoke of was to have married me 20 years ago. She was forced into marrying that same Drebber and broke her heart over it. I took the marriage ring from her dead finger, and I vowed that his dying eyes should rest upon that very ring, and that his last thoughts should be of the crime for which he was punished. I have carried it about with me, and I have followed him and his accomplice over two continents until I caught them. They thought to tire me out, but they could not do it. If I die tomorrow, as is likely enough, I die knowing that my work in this world is done and well done. They have perished, and by my hand. There is nothing left for me to hope for or to desire. See, I was able to make my living in London by driving a cab. I would dog them and follow them until I saw my opportunity. With my beard, they would not recognize me, but they were very cunning, though. They would never go out alone and never after nightfall. Drebber himself was drunk half the time. Then one evening, they quickly left their boarding house in Torquay Terrace and with their luggage, ordered a cab to Euston.
Is this the Liverpool train?
Just gone, sir.
Oh, Christ, I told you we should have left earlier.
When is the next one?
Won't be another for some hours, sir.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Don't fret, sir. I have a little business of my own to deal with. Perhaps you could wait a while. I shall not be very long.
You can't do that. You promised that we would stick together. I'll come with you. It's not worth the risk.
No, you don't understand. This is a delicate matter. I must go alone.
For God's sake, Strebber, you've never been able to keep your hands off women. She might be poor, but she won't give you the time of day.
Then you say, you said, just remember, you're nothing but my paid servant. Don't you ever presume to tell me what to do with my life?
Go if you must, but let's not forget there's a hunter on our tail. If you miss the next train, let's arrange to meet at Halliday's private hotel.
The next train to Liverpool leaves at 11. I'll be back on this platform.
The moment for which I had waited so long had at last come. I had my enemies within my power. One of my regular clients looked after some empty houses in Brixton. He had dropped the key to one of them in my carriage. I duplicated it before returning it to him. By this means, I had access to at least one spot in this great city where I could be free from interruption. How to get Drebber into that house was the difficult problem which I had to solve. He was drinking heavily and, to my astonishment, returned to the lodging house in Torquay Terrace. I waited outside for 15 minutes.
Get out of our house or I'll thrash you to death.
Get your hands off of me.
You hound. I'll teach you to insult an only girl.
I'll say and do what I like, young man, and I won't be better.
If you don't get out. Driver, Chris, take me up. Halliday's private hotel.
When I had him fairly inside my cab, my heart jumped so high with joy, I feared that my aneurysm might burst. I drove along slowly, weighing in my own mind what was best to do. I might take him right out into the country and there, in some deserted lane, have my last interview with him. But suddenly, he solved the problem for me.
Stop here. Here, I tell you.
Yes, sir.
One good thing about this goddamn city is the gin palaces. Wait here.
Right, sir.
And there I waited until closing time. When he came out, he was so far gone, I knew the game was in my own hands. Don't imagine that I intended to kill him in cold blood. Years ago, I had worked as a janitor in the laboratory of New York College, and I had been lucky enough to obtain a deadly South American arrow poison. Poison so powerful that the least grain meant instant death. I worked this poison into small, soluble pills, and each pill I put into a box with a similar pill made without poison. I determined at the time that when I had my chance, each gentleman should draw a pill out of the box and that I would eat the pill that remained. If any of you have ever pined for a thing and longed for it during 20 long years and suddenly found it within your reach, you would understand my feelings. I lit a cigar and puffed at it to steady my nerves, but my hands were trembling and my temples throbbing with excitement. As I drove, I could see old John Ferrier looking at me. Just as plain as I see you all in this room. All the way there, they were ahead of me, one on each side of the horse, until I pulled up at the house in Brixton Road. When I looked in at the window, I found Drebber all huddled together in a drunken sleep.
It's time to get out, sir.
All right, cabby. Coming.
All right, now, mind the step there, sir. Yeah. It's a nice gentleman. That's all right, sir.
All right.
Careful now. Mind your step.
Oh.
I suppose he thought we had come to the hotel that he had mentioned, for he got out without another word and followed me down the garden. I had to walk beside him to keep him steady, for he was still a little top-heavy. When we came to the door, I opened it and led him into the front room. I give you my word that all the way, the father and daughter were walking in front of us.
It's infernally dark.
We'll soon have light. I'll start this candle. Now, Enoch Drebber, who am I?
You
dog! I've hunted you all the way from Salt Lake City to St. Petersburg, and you've always escaped me. Now, at last, your wanderings have come to an end, for either you or I shall never see tomorrow's sunrise. I could see on his face that he thought that I was mad. So I was for the time. The pulses in my temples beat like sledgehammers, and I believe I would have had a fit of some sort if the blood had not gushed from my nose.
Oh, it can't be you. It's impossible. Stangerson!
What do you think of Lucy Ferrier now? Punishment has been slow in coming, but it has overtaken you at last.
Would you murder me?
There is no murder. Who talks of murdering a mad dog? What mercy had you upon my poor darling when you dragged her from her slaughtered father and bore her away to your accursed and shameless harem?
Was it I who killed her father?
It was you who broke her innocent heart. Let the high God judge between us. Choose and eat. There is death in one and life in the other. I shall take what you leave. Let us see if there is justice upon the earth or if we are ruled by chance.
Oh, no, no, I beg you, brother. I have not murdered a living creature. You must understand the power of the avenging angels. I had no choice. Mercy, please.
I knew you were cowards, and without the power of others, you would never dare to risk your lives in any cause. But as sure as you feel the blade of this knife against your throat, you shall swallow one of those pills. He eventually obeyed me, and I swallowed the other. And we stood facing one another in silence for a minute or more, waiting to see which was to live and which was to die. Shall I ever forget the look which came over his face when the first warning pangs told him that poison was in his system? I laughed as I saw it, and I held Lucy's marriage ring in front of his very eyes. The blood had been streaming from my nose, but I had taken no notice of it. I don't know what it was that put it into my head to write upon the wall with it. Perhaps it was some mischievous idea of setting the police upon the wrong track, for I felt light-hearted and cheerful. I remembered a German being found in New York with the word Rache written up above him, and it was argued at the time in the newspapers that the secret societies must have done it. I guessed that what puzzled the New Yorkers would puzzle the Londoners. So I dipped my finger in my own blood and printed it on a convenient place on the wall. Having driven some distance from that house in Brixton, I put my hand into the pocket in which I usually kept Lucy's ring and found it was not there. I was thunderstruck. It was the only memento I had of her. I realized that I must have dropped it when stooping over Drebber's body. I was ready to dare anything rather than lose that ring. Back at the house, I walked straight into the arms of a police officer and only managed to disarm his suspicions by pretending to be hopelessly drunk. Stangerson was staying at Halliday's private hotel, and he was more cunning. I hung about all day, but he never came out. I fancy that he suspected something when Drebber failed to put in an appearance, but I soon found out which was the window of his bedroom, and early next morning I took one of the ladders which were lying in the lane behind the hotel.
What the hell?
Joseph Stangerson,
The hour has come when you are to answer for the life you took so mercilessly 20 years ago. Brother Drebber is dead.
How can any man be so twisted by vengeance? We're talking about events 20 years old.
Not for me, Stangerson. The innocent faces of that beautiful young woman and her good father are as fresh to me as the look of terror on Drebber's face that I left in Brixton only a matter of hours ago.
We all have to learn to forgive.
I will tell you how dear Brother Drebber died. Here. 2 pills. 1 will kill in seconds. We drew and left it to God's mercy. And that's the forgiveness I'm going to give you, Stangerson. 1 will live, the other will die. A chance old John Ferrier never had.
You're mad. I'll kill you with my own 2 bare hands.
Murderer!
In self-defense, I stabbed him in the heart. It would have been the same in any case, for Providence would never have allowed his guilty hand to pick out anything but the poison. I have little more to say, and it's as well, for I am about done up. I went on cabbing it for a day or so, intending to keep at it until I could save enough to take me back to America. I was standing in the yard when a ragged youngster asked me if there was a cabbie called Jefferson Hope, and said that his cab was wanted by a gentleman at 221B Baker Street. I went round, suspecting no harm, and the next thing I knew, this young man here had the bracelets on my wrists and as neatly shackled as I ever saw in my life. That's the whole of my story, gentlemen. You may consider me to be a murderer, but I hold that I am just as much an officer of justice as you are.
There is only one point in which I would like a little more information. Who was your accomplice? Who came for the ring which I advertised?
I can tell you my own secrets, but I don't get other people into trouble. I saw your advertisement, and I thought it might be a plant, or it might be the ring which I wanted. My friend volunteered to go and see. I think you'll own he did it smartly.
No doubt about that.
Now, gentlemen, the forms of the law must be complied with. On Thursday, the prisoner will be brought before the magistrates, and your attendance will be required. Until then, I'll be responsible for him.
My dear Holmes, I've just returned from the police court. I was called about 2 hours ago. Mr. Jefferson Hope was found this morning stretched upon the floor with a placid smile on his face. The aneurysm burst last night. I can assure you from the expression I saw, I think in his dying moments he was able to look back upon a useful life and on work well done.
Gregson and Lestrade will be wild about his death. Where will their grand advertisement be now?
I don't see that they had very much to do with his capture.
What you do in this world is a matter of no consequence. The question is, what can you make people believe that you have done? Never mind. I would not have missed the investigation for anything. There has been no better case within my recollection. Simple as it was, there were several most instructive points about it.
Simple?
Well, really, it can hardly be described as otherwise. The proof of its intrinsic simplicity is that without any help save a very few ordinary deductions, I was able to lay my hands upon the criminal within 3 days.
That's true.
In solving a problem like this, the grand thing is to be able to reason backwards. Let me endeavor to show you the different steps of my reasoning. To begin at the beginning, I examined the footway. I saw clearly the marks of a cab and not a private carriage by the narrow gauge of its wheels. In the clay soil, I saw the heavy footmarks of the constable, but I also saw the track of the 2 men who had first passed through the garden. One was remarkable for his height because of the length of his stride, and the other was fashionably dressed because of the small and elegant impression left by his boots. In the house, the body of the well-booted man lay before me. By inference, the tall one then had done the murder, if murder there was. There was no wound upon the dead man's person, but the agitated expression upon his face assured me that he had foreseen his fate before it came upon him. Men who die from heart disease or any other sudden natural cause never by any chance exhibit agitation upon their faces. Having sniffed the dead man's lips, I detected a slightly sour smell and came to the conclusion that poison had been forced upon him. The forcible administration of poison is by no means a new thing in the criminal annals. The cases of Dalsky in Odessa and of Leturier in Montpellier will occur to any experienced toxicologist. And now the great question, the reason why. It was not robbery. Nothing had been taken. Was it politics or was it a woman? Political assassins are only too glad to do their work and fly. This murder had been done most deliberately, and the perpetrator had left his tracks all over the room. It must have been a private affair, and not a political one, which called for such a methodical revenge. That blood-red writing upon the wall, far too evident, as a blind. Finding the ring settled the question. Clearly the murderer had used it to remind the victim of some dead or absent woman. I then proceeded to examine the room, confirming the murderer's height, establishing his penchant for trichinopoly cigars, and the length of his fingernails. Since there were no signs of a struggle, the blood which covered the floor must have burst from the murderer's nose in his excitement. The track of blood coincided with the track of his feet. It is seldom that any man, unless he is very full-blooded, breaks out in bleeding through emotional distress, so I hazarded the opinion that the criminal was probably a robust and ruddy-faced man. Events have proved that I had judged correctly. Having left the house, I proceeded to do what Gregson had neglected. I telegraphed the head of the police in Cleveland, limiting my inquiry to the circumstances of Enoch Drebber's marriage. The answer was conclusive. Drebber had applied for the protection of the law against an old rival in love, named as Jefferson Hope, and that this same Hope was at present in Europe. All that remained to do now was to secure the murderer. I had determined that the man who had walked into the house with Drebber was none other than the man who had driven the cab. If one man wished to dog another through the streets of London, what better means could he adopt than to turn cab driver? If Jefferson Hope had been one, there was no reason to believe that he had ceased to be. Any sudden change would be likely to draw attention to himself. He would probably, for a time, continue to perform his duties. There was no reason to suppose that he was going under an assumed name. Why should he change his name in a country where no one knew his original one? I therefore organized my street urchin detective corps and sent them systematically to every cab proprietor in London until they ferreted out the man that I wanted. The murder of Stangerson was an incident which was entirely unexpected, but which could hardly in any case have been prevented. You see, the whole thing is a chain of logical sequences without a break or flaw.
It is wonderful. Your merits should be publicly recognized. You should publish an account of the case. If you won't, I will.
You may do what you like, Doctor. See here. Just look at this.
Ah, the Evening Echo. The public have lost a sensational treat through the sudden death of the man Hope, who was suspected of the murder of Mr. Enoch Drebber and Mr. Joseph Stangerson.
The details of the case will probably be never known, though we are informed upon good authority that the crime was the result of an old-standing and romantic feud in which love and Mormonism bore a part. If the case has had no other effect, it at least brings out in the most striking manner the efficiency of our detective police force and will serve as a lesson to all foreigners that they will do wisely to settle their feuds at home and not to carry them onto British soil.
It is an open secret that the credit of this smart capture belongs entirely to the well-known Scotland Yard officials, Messrs. Lestrade and Gregson. The man was apprehended, it appears, in the rooms of a certain Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who has himself, as an amateur, shown some talent in the detective line, and who, with some instructors, may hope in time to attain to some degree of their skill. It is expected a testimonial of some sort will be presented to the two officers as a fitting recognition of their services.
Didn't I tell you when we started? That's the result of our study in Scarlet, to get them a testimonial.
Never mind, Holmes. I have all the facts in my journal, and the public shall know them. By Jove, they will.
Dr. Watson was as good as his word. The 1887 issue of Beaton's Christmas Annual carried this first story of Sherlock Holmes. The author was one Arthur Conan Doyle, but the story was subtitled being a reprint from the reminiscences of John H. Watson, M.D., late of the Army Medical Department. And the rest, as they say, was history. Edward Petherbridge was Sherlock Holmes, with David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. Vincent Marzello was Jefferson Hope. Joe Dunlap was Inspector Gregson, and Mike Shannon was Inspector Lestrade. Other members of the cast included Alexandra Mothy, Richard Shannon, Kay Clayton, and Mike McCormick. The story was adapted for radio by Tim Crook, with violin music performed by Robert Gibbs and Michiku Ueno. I'm Steve Zakar. Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the Chrysler Corporation Fund and the Bell Atlantic Charitable Foundation. Sherlock Holmes will be back in A Scandal in Bohemia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.